This is Sharp Money with Patrick Maher and Amal Shaw on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network.
It's always football season here at VSiN, which is why we've already released our NFL betting guide. Our NFL betting guide will help you get ahead of the upcoming NFL season with in-depth profiles of every team, including advanced stats, proven betting systems, and proprietary betting trends, plus best bets on the season, win totals, futures, and props. Become a VSiN Pro subscriber today for as low as $19 a month and get your digital copy of the VSiN NFL betting guide, or take advantage of the summer kickoff special and get access to everything we do through the Super Bowl for only $175. Sign up today at VSiN.com/subscribe. Welcome back into a Tuesday edition of Sharp Money. Here I'm Mike Somich. We've got Amal Shaw and Dustin Sweetelson joining us from Las Vegas, the beautiful South Point Resort and Casino. And on the line now, we got Barrett Salee, CBS college sports football writer, at Barrett Salee on Twitter. Barrett, thank you very much for joining us today. I know it's been a busy couple days with everything coming out of Northwestern. Let's start out there. How did we get here from what happened on Friday?
A lot of people came out of the woodwork, right? I mean, the 2-week suspension on Friday kind of, you know, surprised a lot of us. And then it almost felt like they were trying to walk that back. And then, bam, you know, everything started coming to light. So it's been poorly handled all around. You know, Pat Fitzgerald, obviously, it's been poorly handled by him. But I think for the entire Northwestern administration, they kind of got caught with their hands tied. They didn't know what to do. They had the 2-week suspension. Looking back, it's almost like they wanted to find every way to keep Pat Fitzgerald and didn't think that this would be dug into any longer. I guess they forgot that their journalism school was the best in the country because, of course, now the student newspaper comes out and brings all this to light. So poorly handled all around. But I think the biggest thing is that Northwestern just assumed that they could get away with the 2-week suspension. And clearly that was not the case.
Barrett, I said college football coaches know more about their programs than dictators know about their own countries. Are you surprised to see some of these things still continuing on after what we've seen at New Mexico State, among other programs elsewhere?
Yeah, absolutely. Because like you said, you know, we've got a precedent for this. You know, basketball, New Mexico is obviously a huge deal at New Mexico State. We've seen other instances of mistreatment of players to various degrees in various ways, right, with various outcomes. And I don't want to get into comparing one to the other, because some of those are very serious, more serious than what we've had right now. But yes, I think the idea that hazing should exist to this point, it's not reality in this day and age. It just can't happen in this day and age. If you want to play some jokes on the youngsters, fine. You know, I know in Major League Baseball, sometimes the Braves rookies have to walk to the bullpen with pink backpack, My Little Pony backpacks on. Sure, fine, whatever. You know, I think, but going to this degree, you know, let's take away whether it's right or wrong to have that kind of hazing. It's just dumb because you know you're going to get caught regardless now. And me personally, you know, this stuff should not happen. And I'm glad they're going to put a stop to it. And a lot of schools have put a stop to it. And if you haven't, what are you waiting for? You know, from a human perspective, you shouldn't do it. But even if you don't care, you know, you're going to get caught regardless.
Talking to Barrett Salee here, CBS college football writer, at Barrett Salee on Twitter. Join us talking everything college football here. And one of the things you tweeted out recently was this Northwestern job was an attractive job. It'd be interesting to see what they happen moving forward here. Amal and I disagree on this. I don't think it's a very good job, specifically in this NIL landscape. Convince me why this is such a good job here at Northwestern that's now opened up.
Well, I disagree with you, the NIL landscape, although I will say that that's not the primary reason. But you're in the heart of Chicago, in your suburbs of Chicago. You're in a very, very rich area of Chicago. You have very, very rich alumni. So if you become a decent program, you're going to get a lot of NIL money. Now, that's not the primary reason, though. To me, the Big Ten money that is going to start kicking in the new TV deal is huge, because you're going to be able to, whether you're Northwestern, whether you're Ohio State, doesn't matter, you're going to be able to devote way more resources than anybody else in the country right this very second. Now the SEC is going to join that fray as well, but the ability to win, to lure coaches, to build better facilities. And for Northwestern, they don't even need to build a better facility for practice. They live in that's like a palace over there on the lake. Football stadium. Yes, they need some help there, but it's a very attractive job because it's a Big Ten job. And they've already shown that they the desire to play and win at an elite level, because like I said, that football facility there is the nicest in the country. And then beyond that, you know, if you're and when you're a Power Five coach, if you're Matt Campbell at Iowa State in the Big 12, if you're Mike Elko in the ACC and the at Duke, why would you not want to go after a program, a job like that, where you know you already have the dedication? And then you're going to have even more resources than you know what to do with from a financial standpoint. So it's a good job. You know, if you're a coach at a place where, you know, you kind of can't win a national championship, why not do that at Northwestern, where you've got a lot of positive ways to improve your life from a financial standpoint and the players' lives from not only a financial standpoint, but also from a training standpoint.
Love the breakdown there. I would agree with you completely. You're a huge college football guy, just like myself. Let's get into this. Well, let me ask you this question. Kirby Smart couldn't schedule the Valdosta Wildcats. Is that why they're not on the schedule this year? I mean, this is the biggest criminal joke of a schedule I've ever seen in the history of college football. I mean, they play one team, Barrett, that's got a season win total over 7.5. That's on Rocky Top, only because of the rivalry.
Yes. Part of this is not at Georgia's fault. They had Oklahoma on the roster.
I know.
You know, so I mean, it's one of those things where, okay, had the SEC move not happened, it'd be Oklahoma. The rest, really, is it Georgia's fault that everybody else in the East is terrible? I mean, yeah, for 60 minutes a season it is, but you know, it's not their fault that their division is terrible and they have to play those teams. They do have a rotator in Ole Miss, yep, that I think is pretty good. It's not their fault they're not playing Alabama. You know, that's just the way the rotation works. And it's not their fault Georgia Tech's a train wreck. And, you know, so I see it as, and I'm not going to necessarily make excuses. Well, maybe I am going to make excuses. They should be playing Oklahoma. Through no fault of their own, that game got canceled. They are playing Georgia Tech, as they do every single year. They're playing 10 Power 5 opponents total. Or they should be playing 10 Power 5 opponents. It's only 9 through no fault of Georgia's own, and the out-of-conference one that they still have on the schedule is awful. So, I mean, I get this question a lot, and my response is, you know, what did you want them to do? Like, there's nothing they could have done. I mean, there's obviously some things they could have done, but they're going to have if they think they're going to have 2 Power 5 opponents on their schedule, one of them is an almost annual college football playoff contender. I mean, the effort was there. I mean, how can you fault them for the fact that they bad luck happened?
No, you make a great argument, and you're correct in everything you said. I'm just a little bit annoyed still, probably because Ryan Day didn't go for it on 4th-and-1 at the 34-yard line, but that's another story.
I get that 100%.
But the reality of it is, to me, here's the one thing that I said I propose. I think Georgia's going undefeated. Their season win total is at 11 and 11.5, okay, at different places. I don't see the possibility of having 2 losses on the schedule. Their furthest game this year by car is Nashville. And the reality of it is they don't have any difficulty in travel. But let me ask you this. If they lose to Alabama or LSU or anyone else in the SEC title game, SC potentially undefeated, Michigan, Ohio State, mean in Ann Arbor at 11-0, is there a chance that Georgia, with this anemic schedule, loses the SEC but doesn't get into the playoff?
No. And look, here's the thing. I always like to couch every playoff discussion in July as we'll see how the landscape evolves. Sure. If Georgia has 1 loss and it's in the SEC championship game, it's going to get the benefit of the doubt. Whether people like that or not, 2 straight national championships is going to get them the benefit of the doubt, even if it's subconsciously in the minds of the playoff selection committee. I don't think that should be the case. I view every season as an individual season and throw out everything happened in previous season. That's what I love college football. That's part of the reason I think it's a fantastic sport, is because you can have those arguments all season long and people approach them in different ways. But the reality is, yes, if Georgia loses an SEC championship game and that's the only loss, they'll get in. And some of the reason, part of the explanation will probably be, oh, well, they played their way into a bonus game in which they lost. I mean, that's
great stuff.
Whether you think that's a good whether you think that's the right way to approach it or not, that's going to be one way to approach it.
Great stuff, Barrett. Really appreciate you jumping in here. Barrett Slee, CBS College Sports Football Writer. You can check him out at Barrett Slee on Twitter. I'm glad you were able to set them all straight on this Georgia thing. They're going to get into that playoff, even if they lose that SEC title game.
We might have to have you back on if they don't, but we'll see what happens.
We'll be back after this break on Sharp Money. Talk a little about Dustin's future tickets and which ones are dead and which ones are alive.
This is Sharp Money with Patrick Maher and Amal Shah on VSIN, the Sports Betting Network.
Welcome back into Sharp Money here. Mike Somich filling in for Patrick Maher. We've got Amal Shah and Dustin Swedelson there in South Point Casino in Las Vegas. Rolling along here with hour two of Sharp Money. Bringing in one of my favorite guests to listen to, Zach Harper, the Athletic NBA writer at Talk Hoops on Twitter. One of the busiest mans out there. Has three different podcasts going, Count the Dings, the Athletic NBA Show, and Cinephobe. And just got back. Are you currently in Vegas for Summer League? You still out there?
No, I got back yesterday. I foolishly went there like 2 days before with my girlfriend. We're like, oh, we'll get a couple of days, you know, just have, you know, we needed a little bit of time. And that was like 6-7 days in Vegas. No offense to anyone who lives there. That's hell. It's just too much.
Well, you got the Vegas voice going there, yeah, Zach. Exactly. I love it. Tell us about the summer experience.
About as good as it gets.
The summer experience. Go for it.
Yeah, so Summer League's great, man. I've been going for I think my first one was 2009. So I'm a veteran of this thing at this point. But you know, you get in there, you start talking to people. All of a sudden, you realize nobody's watching the basketball, and then everybody's watching basketball because Victor Wembanyama's there, and it's just one blur into another. It all blends together. I couldn't tell you if you know Tyreek Evans made his Summer League debut 2 years ago or 14 years ago. I don't know at this point. It all blends together into one big moment of me just giving away money.
Zach, the Summer League feels like one of two things for me. It's for a lot of fans that may not be able to access or have the affordability to go to an NBA game. And then the second thing is it's like the Final Four. It's just basically like a coaches conference and an opportunity for people to network and kind of catch up with people they may not see during the regular year. Is there anything more to it than that? Obviously, Warren Legere's making some money with it, but other than that, I feel like this is just kind of a showcase of nothing really.
Yeah, I mean, there are people who are legitimately carving out careers both off the court and on the court, right? Yeah. Like someone may get an invite that they weren't going to get, or someone may get noticed by an international team. Like that's the thing. It's not just about the NBA. Like there is a lot of international influence. One thing I found out years ago, this must have been 6-7 years ago, which I didn't know before, and I don't know if it's actually still happening, but apparently like it might be like the Korean Basketball League or the Taiwanese Basketball League. It's like one of these international basketball leagues over in Asia. They do like a draft at the end of Summer League or maybe during Summer League, but they'll pick we drafted Wembanyama, right? Like knowing they won't get him, but just on the off chance that he decides someday, yeah, I'll go to Korea. I'll go play in Korea. Like some teams is like, we got him. We're going to dominate this thing. So there's just all these like little instances of basketball culture and basketball adjacent things happening at all times, but it is mostly an excuse for the NBA to say, what if we spent 12 days in Vegas? How badly could that go?
No, let's just have a little bit of fun there. Why not? Right. Let's talk about two of the guys in Vegas. We just had a discussion around rookie of the year, and obviously that centers around Victor Wembanyama, -220, -250 in a lot of the markets around town. I watched both the Summer League games from Hawaii. The wife was not happy with that decision for me, but I had to do it because I wanted to see him play. My biggest takeaway, man, I'm scared he's going to get hurt. It looked like he fell 5 or 6 times, just kind of awkwardly after trying to block a shot or after going toward the hoop. What was your takeaways from seeing Victor play?
I think tall people fall. You know, like I know, like that may not be great analysis, but I think tall people just fall a lot more than we do. And look, I'm not really worried about him getting injured. He does a lot of prep. He's been doing a lot of prep for his body that has been very progressive and kind of new age. And he, you know, he does these barefoot workouts to make sure his feet are strong before the game and everything. Like he's doing as much prep as you can to stay, you know, to stay healthy and to make sure that nothing goes wrong. It doesn't mean nothing will go wrong, but I don't expect him to have the same possibilities of injury as big men of the past because of the way he's been handled from a young age. But I just walked away thinking this guy is awesome. I know he struggled to shoot the ball in game one. He had a bad game and had five blocks. He dropped like five or six dimes that we didn't see and didn't expect out of him. He didn't show that much until kind of the playoffs in France. Once the shot was going, you realize nobody can block it. Like he's going to draw so many fouls on jumpers because people are trying to contest it best they can. And you just can't get to that reach. Like it's just impossible. And so I think at worst, he's going to draw a ton of fouls. He's going to get some easy buckets here and there. He's going to rebound really well. He's going to defend incredibly well. And as long as he stays healthy, which is always going to be, a big question for guys his size, but as long as he stays healthy, I don't think there's a downside to him at all. Like I do think he is absolutely foolproof, but does that mean he's going to be the greatest prospect ever? No, it just means like they have a star no matter what happens.
Love everything you said about him. And I agree with Mike. I don't think this is a great bet on rookie of the year for him, but I'll tell you what, at 35-1 at DraftKings to win defensive player of the year, Zach, I think, and you guys both play basketball. You played basketball. You understand that when you play someone who is so long and so tall to shoot over them, I'm 6'2", and if I'm being guarded by somebody who's 6'7", it is hard to get a clean look off. Now you're guarded by somebody who's 7'5", with that wingspan, the alteration and the shot blocking off the ball is unbelievable. I think if you genuinely look at the way he can change your defense on balls on help side, Zach, to me, it's going to be huge.
Oh, I mean, look, I was talking to a scout and a couple of executives and they were saying like, Spurs might have a top 10 defense this year. I was like, get out of here. Come on. They're way too young for that. And like, no, they might, like he might be that impactful defensively. I remember the first time I tried to shoot a 3-point shot over a guy who's 7'1". And it felt like I was trying to like throw the ball to the sky, like just like exactly. Try to hit the sun, right? Like that's what it felt like, because it is just, I mean, granted, like I'm 6 foot. So it's like, there's a huge disparity there. Some of these guys are going to be much taller, but it's not just that it's his reach and it's his length and everything. It's the timing. He just understands, like there is an innate thing. It's like Jaren Jackson Jr. with blocking shots. He blocks so many shots before the ball releases from the hand. And it's why I think he's, deserving of defensive player of the year last year. I think it was the right decision because that timing changes everything. I think Victor has the same stuff. Like, yeah, they're going to be a bunch that he just puts a hand up and gets a fingertip on. And you're wondering like, how did he go away with that? But he legitimately could block 4 shots a game just by accident. Just by like a lazy closeout. Like, you know that BS Luke Kornet jumping from the paint when there's no, like, and people are like, oh, it's an interesting strategy. Like, no, it's bad defense. Like, that's what it is. It's not actually like Ike Okoro misses a 3-point shot. We're like, oh, it works. It's like, no, it's just Ike Okoro shooting the ball. Like, that's why it happened. He may actually block those shots. He may get called for goaltending because he jumped from in the paint and got it on the way down. That's how ridiculous his length is.
To your point on the goaltending, though, I think there's a couple factors. I think he might initially get called for more goaltendings than he deserves. But then on the other side, I think he might get away with some because he is so hard to gauge. I don't know what his standing reach is vertically, but I have to tell you, you brought up a great analogy about shooting over someone 7'1". It's not only is he long, right? Like a Rudy Gobert is what, 6'11", 7 feet tall. He's got great length, but now you add 5 inches. And I think he's got some great agility. I think it's going to be a real challenge when you look at how he can alter shots. I wish... And I'm sure they'll quantify it from an analytics standpoint, but the amount of impact, guys, that he's going to have from shot alteration, Mike, to me, it's going to be absolutely huge.
He is going to make it very difficult to get inside the paint against the San Antonio team and get a shot up around the rim. We saw one player be able to do that, and that was in a showcase game. Scoot Henderson took him on and went to the rim against him multiple times. I thought Scoot looked phenomenal in the game that we saw at Summer League as well. Zach, what were your takes on Scoot? How explosive was he in person?
He's so good. He is so unbelievably good. Like, I get that. I get the Blazers. Like, look, we got to slow play this. We got to make sure we get the right package for Dame and everything. I understand that it's good business. It's the right thing. Do not alter the development of Scoot. Like, give him as many minutes, as much of the reins as you possibly can. Like, he's just, he understands the flow of a game so well, the speed of the game. Like, yeah, he's strong. He's athletic. He's skilled. His ability to change speeds at the drop of a hat. Like, I mean, his ability to attack, it's why he was able to get shots off inside against Victor. I don't think he'll have any problem against NBA length and NBA athleticism, because he just knows, like, it's like if you gave Mike Conley the body of a linebacker and the athleticism of, like, you know, maybe Russell Westbrook after two knee surgeries, right? Like, he's so special. His body control is so good, and watching him just be able to completely dictate the flow of a game, like, he's the real deal. He's going to be a superstar. He'll be a top 10 point guard in a couple of years. And just, like, what a find for the Blazers. Like, that's why you tank, folks. That's why you quit on the season 2 years in a row while you claim that you're committed to winning. It's to get someone like Scoot Henderson.
I never disagreed with Sam Hinkie's plan in Philadelphia. It just wound up with the two softest guys in the world, Markelle Fultz and Ben Simmons. It was actually the most, I'm telling you, Zach, I don't understand. If you're not an NBA championship team, and that's the greatest thing about sports, either you win or you're like the other 29 teams, you're a loser. And to me, you should be tanking if you don't have those pieces in place. Now San Antonio could theoretically build around what they have here. Getting back to Henderson real quick, in terms of quickness, is he De'Aaron Fox level quick? Where are we talking in terms of quickness with the basketball?
I think it is in relative, like, I don't know if anyone's quick.
Yeah,
as
I know.
No, nobody. Like, he's pretty, but I think because of the strength, I think because once he accelerates and he turns his shoulder on you, there's nothing you can do. Like, there's just nothing. Like, you have to foul him. You're not going to recover on those moments. His body language and the way he uses his body to his advantage, it's very Luka and Paul Pierce like, in the sense that, like, just once he gets the angle on you, you're screwed. Like, you can't recover because he's too strong and too quick and too athletic.
I said Scoot was going to be first team all NBA within 5 seasons on draft day. I still believe that he's that good and that dominant. He's Derrick Rose-esque to me. And I think he's going to find that jumper because he is one of those guys who loves to live in the gym. Zach, you willing to stick around for one more segment with us?
Let's do it. Yeah, absolutely.
I love it. We can talk about your favorite thing. We can talk a little bit of Dame after the segment here and what's going on there in Portland as well. We'll be right back here on Sharp Money. We got our boy Zach Harper here from the Athletic NBA. One more segment with him. This is Sharp Money.
This is Sharp Money with Patrick Maher and Amal Shaw on VSiN, the sports betting network.
Download the DraftKings app today, and new customers can bet $5 and get $150 in bonus instantly. Use promo code VSiN, VSIN, when you sign up. See DraftKings.com/sportbook for full terms and conditions. Welcome back in here, Sharp Money Tuesday edition. Mike Somich filling in here for Patrick Maher. We've got Amal Shaw, Dustin Sweetelson back at the South Point. And now we're going to talk a little bit of football. We got Emory Hunt, CBS Sports HQ football analyst. You can find him at FBallGame there on Twitter. Emory, how's it going, man?
Doing great, man. I appreciate you guys bringing me on.
Yeah, of course. So looking forward to talking some NFL here. But before we do, we got to let you puff your chest out a little bit. 15-5 in the CFL?
15-5 in the CFL, 25-18 in the XFL, 23-20 in the USFL. So what, 65-43 overall spring and summer? That's pretty amazing, man.
That's pretty good. You don't need the NFL and college football around to be able to make some money on the pigskin. I love it. Let's jump into the NFL real quick. I'm going to let him all ask his question. We know he's going to come at us with some NFC West talk, but let's start with the NFC North here. I have a bet on the Packers +550 to win the division. It seems like you agree that this team's being criminally underrated right now, especially with how many question marks you have in the rest of that division.
Right, and that's the team I have winning the division. I have the Packers winning the NFC North. I feel like people are sleeping on the fact that Jordan Love has been in this offense for 4 years, has a stable of options up front and in the backfield, two good running backs, good weapons at receiver that he has played with and grown with, and they drafted Dontavius Wicks out of Virginia. Big fan of him. They brought in two tight ends, excellent tight ends, to help him out as well. And his defense has great personnel at all three levels. So I feel like people are sleeping on continuity being king, and both not only the quarterback, but also this coaching staff wants to show everybody, hey, man, this wasn't all about Aaron Rodgers. We can coach football. We can play football. So I like them to win that division.
It's interesting. So I'm assuming, look, I agree with you from a talent standpoint. You guys are both correct. Green Bay is being slept on. I think Detroit's getting a ton of hype. But when you look at Jordan Love, just give me a gauge, Emery, of where you kind of see him. He's going to be a guy that comes in. I like the point you made. He's been in the system for a long time. But is he someone that could potentially lead them in situations where it's needed? Because that was the one thing with Rodgers you always felt comfortable and confident with.
Yeah, I feel like he can do so. I feel like he is someone that wants to do it. And he showed it briefly in that game he stepped in for him against Philadelphia. They went right down the field and put the ball in the end zone. They had trouble scoring the ball that game until he got in. And I feel like when you think about what he brings to the table, that level of confidence and now having that benefit of the run game, if you can't run the football and play good run defense in the NFC North, it's going to look like the old NFC Central. You're not going to be able to win games. I think because Green Bay can do both of those things this upcoming season, I feel like that's going to give him a better chance to succeed.
Let's shift gears a little bit. Let's talk about the NFC East here. The two headlining teams in that division, you've got Philadelphia Eagles, the Dallas Cowboys. I think everyone agrees they're going to finish first or second in some order inside of that division. Two of the plays that you like here is the Giants under 7.5 and the Commanders over 6.5. Kind of correlated plays there, because if the Commanders go over, they're going to have to beat the Giants a couple times. Let us know. Tell us why you like the Commanders over and the Giants under.
They're the same exact team, different coats of paint. Ron Rivera is 3-3-1 against three different coaches of the New York Giants, but pretty much a lot of the same personnel that's been on this roster. So for me, if the Giants are just how they are right now with a Saquon Barkley out there, let's say he's out there, they still have questions in the passing game. I know they've made some improvements, but they still have a team full of number twos and number threes at receiver. So if you're a team that can not only get to the quarterback, but also trust your back end to cover, you can essentially take away some of their wide receivers and make things tougher for Daniel Jones, who doesn't want to make the big mistake. So it tends to yield him holding the ball and taking some sacks. So I feel like they kind of can split, and Washington is going to be better because they're built just like the Giants. Great defensive line. I love their secondary. I think they have a better secondary more so than the Giants do. Giants, I feel like, have better linebackers, in my opinion, than do Washington. Giants' old line may be slightly better. They have a better backfield depth across the board, but Washington now has Sam Howell at quarterback, Eric Bieniemy calling the plays, and they have the better receivers in Washington. So you can see where both teams could end up with 7 wins and cancel each other out.
I completely agree with you on your take on the Giants. Look, they had a good year, but they had some wins. Randy Bullock misses the kick in Tennessee early in the season. You played some bad teams in terms of the victories that they had against the Houston Texans. They tied the Commanders. Commanders were playing without quarterback. And talent-wise, guys, I think Washington is just a better football team, minus the quarterback position. And Daniel Jones, to me, boy, you talk about getting a lot of love for one game because Minnesota can't stop the run.
I think I might be the only person in the world who likes that Daniel Jones contract. And it's because I trust the coaching staff. If they're willing to pay him that money, I believe that they think they can make Daniel Jones into that guy. So we'll see how that pans out. I didn't hate that contract, though, Amal.
Emery, you're unaware Mike is his agent. there's nobody could like this contract, but forget about that. Let's go to, I know you guys both like Seattle. I do not. Before you give me the breakdown of why both you guys like Seattle, I'm going to tell you one play, though, I do like with the Hawks this year. Jackson Smith and Jigba is going to win the Offensive Rookie of the Year. I'm going to tell you right now, this kid's going to have a chance to make 100 catches. There is nobody in the slot that's going to be able to stop him. He is one of the best guys at getting off of coverage. I think he's going to be unbelievable.
And you know what's funny about that? Imagine him being your third option. Yeah. That's the crazy part, because now you have DK Metcalf, Tyler Lockett, and Jackson Smith and Jigba. His third, their third option is better than your number one corner, and sometimes your number two corner. So it's going to be a problem. But what does that do? It opens things up for their run game, and now they've doubled down and tripled down in the backfield to add to Kenneth Walker. They bring in Zach Charbonnet. They bring in a homeboy from Georgia. I want to say his name slips my mind, but he's going to be their third receiver, their third back, the guy that catch football and also return kicks. So they got better up front. They got better on defense, and I think they were a year ahead. I liked them last year, and they ended up making the playoffs, but this team was a year ahead with the youth that they had starting at both tackle spots. Now those two guys will be in their second season. And those two young players, and Kobe Bryant and also Tariq Woolen, they're going into their second season. You hope to get a healthy Jamal Adams. This team is more mature and better on both sides going into this season. So, yeah, that's why I like them to win that division.
Mike, I agree with him in the sense of the running game. You're talking about Kenny McIntosh, who I really liked out of UGA. I think this team could be good. I hear the point, but give me one more argument before I counter both of you here.
Well, I think this defense is criminally underrated right now. You get Witherspoon in the draft. You had four defensive starters that were rookies last year. It's a known fact that you have that rookie wall that you hit when you're a defensive player. And if you look at their defensive ratings before and after week 13, you saw that slide start to happen for the Seattle team. Now those players who were rookies last year are all going to be second year players this year. That should help them out a lot. Love Witherspoon as the off ball cornerback as well. He's good. A shutdown guy who's now your number two cornerback. I think that's a huge add. You add Wagner in the middle. So you add that veteran person, you add the run stopping ability at middle linebacker. I think that's a huge help. And oh, by the way, let's look at the schedule. They get to take on San Francisco two plus spots. They play at home on a short week and they play off a semi-long week. So you get 10 days rest before San Francisco, and then San Francisco has to go play you on a short week on Thursday night in Seattle. So you have an edge in both games from a rest perspective and home field advantage against the two San Francisco games. I think the Seattle team, who doesn't have any question marks and improved, is better than San Francisco, who has a ton of question marks at quarterback, and other than that, is returning the same team.
Well, okay, great points you make there in terms of the schedule, but let's break down the Seattle team from last year. 9 wins, 4 of them came against the Rams and the Cardinals. I think Georgia could have beaten a couple of those teams last year. On top of it, you mentioned the 49ers. In 6 halves of football against San Francisco last year, they played well in the first half against San Francisco in the playoff game. In the first game they played in SF, they had an 86-yard field goal block return for a touchdown. In the other game, they were trailing 21-3, got a late Jake Myers field goal, and then a touchdown around garbage time. They were really never in that football game. They get dominated thoroughly in terms of the second half by the Niners. I understand and appreciate your point on the quarterback play, but the one thing we realize with San Francisco, they have arguably 5 to 6 guys in the National Football League, for my money, guys, that are the best individuals at their position. CMC, Deebo Samuel, George Kittle, Trent Williams, Fred Warner, Nick Bosa. And then you add in Hargrave from Philadelphia, who's as good as anybody on the defensive line. Eric Armstead's going to be healthy. I can appreciate what you guys are saying. I still have question marks about Geno Smith. I love the point Emery made about the receivers. They're absolute dudes. I think Tyler Lockett has been criminally underrated his whole career.
Tyler Lockett over yards is to me a lock this year. He's sitting, I think, like 756 is his over under on the yard side. I think he's going way over it. Emery, tell them all why he's wrong here. We're winning this division. How, what are we going to go? 12-5 somewhere in there? That'll get the job done. I don't think San Francisco's as good as they are last year.
Well, he makes great points about the talent on both sides, which is why people like San Francisco. But quarterback question marks at the start of the season is going to push them back to where now they're going to be playing from behind in terms of like in terms of wins. So that's going to be the biggest thing for me, because you don't want to throw out an unhealthy Brock Purdy, who also had a lot of drop interceptions. You don't want to throw out Sam Darnold, who throws a catchable interception. And you don't know what you're going to get from Trey Lance, who does a great job at just playing consistent ball, but he can't stay healthy. So if they can't figure that out within the first quarter of the season, I feel like if they lose 2 games or 3 games, that puts them behind Seattle, who can get off to a great start.
Emery's right on Sam Darnold. You talk about a turnover machine.
It's going to be trouble there up there. Emery, thank you very much for joining us. CBS Sports HQ football analyst. You can find him at FBallGame over on Twitter. Appreciate you, man. Thank you very much.
Follow his CFL picks. He's on fire.
No kidding. All right, we'll be right back. More Sharp Money on the other side of the break.
This is Sharp Money with Patrick Maher and Amal Shaw on VSIN, the Sports Betting Network.
Welcome back here to Sharp Money, rolling into the third hour. Mike Somich filling in for Patrick Maher. We got Amal Shaw, Dustin Sweetelson back there in Las Vegas, and I am pumped for our next guest here, Max Brown, joining us from the Pac-12 Network at MaxBrown4 on Twitter. A wonderful Twitter follow. We'll get into some of those videos that I absolutely love from you, Max. You played quarterback for USC from 2013 to 2016 at Pittsburgh in 2017. You were the number one recruit in the 2013 class. I want to start there because I will never be the number one recruit in anything in my life. What was it like in that recruitment process, and how early did you start getting letters and schools that came at you?
Yeah, what's up, guys? Thanks for having me on. And it's cool to get that question, because I feel like nowadays, being a decade removed, that's not always the intro I get. I get the first two points you talked about, but it was crazy. It was a totally different era than it is now, which is crazy. I mean, I'm only 28 years old, but the whole recruiting landscape was way different back then. Social media was not part of my recruitment, but I got my first offer from the hometown school, University of Washington.
I think we lost Max there. Well, hopefully we can get him back in a second there. But Mike, I love your question. This is a guy won three straight state titles, was twice the Gatorade Player of the Year up in, I think, where was he? Sammamish or Sammamish? I'm sure I butchered the name there, whichever school he was at there up in Sammamish. I think Matisse Thybul is from there as well. But you're absolutely right. That's a great question. Hopefully we can get him back on to hear the rest of his answer there.
It would be... Oop, I think we got Max back here. Max, do we have you?
You got me. Yeah, okay. Sorry. Not sure what happened right there. But, to finish what I was saying, just got the hometown offer from the University of Washington, which the head coach was Steve Sarkisian at the time. And then, funny enough, 2 years later, I ended up playing for him at USC. So things came full circle.
Max, let's talk about the Trojans right now. Obviously, Caleb Williams, all the hype, justifiably so, reigning Heisman Trophy winner. This offense is electric. The young kid, Zion Branch, for people that are not familiar with him, Zachariah Branch, his brother Zion's on the defensive side of the ball. But this kid's going to be unbelievable. I think this USC offense can be great. But here's my problem with the Trojans. I don't know if Lincoln Riley is best friends with Alex Grinch or why this guy continues to be the defense coordinator there. This, to me, is the problem with the Trojans. How do you see USC, and particularly on the defensive side of the ball, this year?
I think first and foremost, the depth there on the front seven especially is going to be night and day different. I think last year you saw that, hey, maybe their starting edge rusher was a notable player, but the second that you got into the backup or the second that that starter got injured, that's where USC got decimated. And as a result, they had to put their entire defensive structure around Tuli Tuifulotu, who was a popular name in the NFL draft. Obviously, he's gone, and they're going to have to replace him. But I think scheme-wise, they're probably going to be very much the same, which I know is of the concern to some USC fans, but I think just the overall talent in depth will certainly help USC. I expect the defense to be better. And I know a lot of folks out west have the Alex Grinch memories from his days at Washington State, where they were, you know, one of the most productive defenses in the country. And obviously it's been a few years ago, but you saw glimpses of that last year. But this will no doubt be a huge year for Alex Grinch. They've got to take a huge step, because we saw it in the Cotton Bowl a year ago. The defense is the Achilles heel for USC, and if that's the case this year, they're not going to make the playoff, which I know is the goal for most USC fans.
And they did a phenomenal job in the transfer portal. Ended up getting the number one defensive tackle from Georgia, Bear Alexander, in that portal, as well as the number one offensive lineman from Wyoming. So we're able to retool on the fly there. I think it's six defensive players they added through the transfer portal, specifically in that front seven, which you mentioned. So it'll be interesting to see what they're able to do. This is a phenomenal year to be a Pac-12 analyst. There are so many different storylines. You've got Washington, you've got Bo Nix. But let's talk about Deion Sanders in Colorado a little bit here. The total for Colorado opened at 4. That's been bet down pretty drastically. I think it's sitting at 3, juice to the under right now for a win total. What do you expect from this program in year one of the Deion Sanders era?
Man, that's the guessing game of all guessing games. I mean, it's remarkable for me. I had their spring game a year ago, and just where that program's come over the course of a calendar year, it's unheard of, and obviously it's well documented on all sports talk and college football shows. But I do think that number of that 3-4 win number is appropriate, which, as we all know, Vegas is usually spot on with those things. But I think if you were just a national college football fan, you might be shocked by that number, expecting it to be much higher, especially with all the headlines that Colorado has. But it is going to be difficult to find to come by wins in the Pac-12 this year, because you can go down the conference and you can find a way to really get excited, really excited about the top 10 teams. I think Stanford and Cal are going to have an uphill battle this year, but every other team, you can find a way why they can be an 8-win team, why they can be the surprise team in the conference, or You know, there's a good five teams in the conference that can make a legitimate argument that they should be the favorites to win the conference championship. Oregon State being the fifth there, which might be a stretch to some, but don't say that to an Oregon State fan. That was a team that was really impressive last year and returns a ton of talent. So it's going to be hard to find wins. And when you look at Colorado's schedule, that first half of the year with the out-of-conference games, TCU and Nebraska, and then their first two conference games are USC and Oregon. It's going to be tough for Coach Prime to get wins. I think they'll be awfully competitive. I think they'll be leaps and bounds better than last year. But I do think that that 3 or 4 win number is appropriate.
Yeah, it's a great point you make there. We're talking to Max Brown, Pac-12 Network analyst, former college football player. Max, I want to ask you about what to me is the best coach in the league, which is Kyle Whittingham. His team returns 8 starters on defense. You bring back your quarterback and, of course, a couple of key offensive pieces there. I'm talking about Cam Rising coming back. Tell me where you see this team going for a third straight Pac-12 title. I thought the performance we saw in the second half by them against USC in Los Angeles was tremendous. I'm sorry, in Las Vegas.
Yeah, the Utes are Utes have been mainstays in the pack, and it feels like now they're getting the rightful credit nationally as well. And I think to me, the first question is Cam Rising's health. From what I understand, he did not participate in spring ball, and that knee is going to be that he had surgically repaired. It's going to be something that's front of mind even going into fall camp. And I think it was a huge win that Utah got Andy Ludwig, their offensive coordinator, back. There was rumors, if listeners recall, that he was going to jump to Notre Dame back in January and February. Luckily, the Utes got him back, and that's huge from a camaraderie standpoint. But Rising's health, you lost Kincaid to the NFL. Brant Keithy will be back, which will be a huge – he's the other tight end that probably would have also been a first or second round pick if he stayed healthy, and keep an eye on him as far as the 2024 NFL draft. But there are some health concerns, some, you know, where's the receiver room at? You know, where's the running back position room at? You lose Tavion Thomas, their starting running back who'd been there for a while. So I think Utah, if we've learned one thing, Utah's going to reload. They're going to be a very good football team. But to my earlier point, Oregon's there, Washington's there, USC's there, Oregon State's there. Not going to be an easy climb for Utah, but I've learned one thing since starting to cover this conference 5 years ago. Don't bet against Kyle Whittingham and his bunch.
It's tough to go in there in Utah and get a W. This is a really deep conference this year. I don't think people understand, and you've outlined multiple teams here who are going to be good football teams in this spot. It's been a struggle to get a team to the playoffs for the Pac-10 or Pac-12. I'm sorry. They've not been able to do so for a while. USC seems like the logical pick to be able to try and make that run this year. Do you think there's going to be a team in the playoffs this year from the Pac-12? And if it's not USC, who else could jump up there and get into the playoff?
Man, I hope so, because it feels like nationally that's what people latch onto in terms of the overall narrative with the conference is, oh, you can't get someone in, can't get someone in. And this year, you're going to have 5 teams ranked inside of the top 15 to start the year, most likely, or at least top 16, top 17. So the quality is going to be there. There's going to be some really good football played out west. But again, with the 9 conference game schedules, I think it's going to be hard to have a team go completely unscathed. And if a team gets in, my bet is it's going to be a 1-loss team, just given the strength of the conference. But if it's not USC, keep your eye on Washington and Oregon, and in large part because of the quarterback play. You have Bo Nix, who, you know, he's been around forever, and you have a lot of talent coming back for Oregon. It'll be interesting to see how they reload defensively and the steps that Bo Nix can take. But then for Washington, we have yet to see Michael Penix play with a full off season of no injuries, of no position battles, of nothing but confidence, and that's what I'm excited for. Up in the Northwest. I mean, Michael Penix, largely regarded as that number 2 quarterback going into the year behind Caleb Williams, and rightfully so. He also got his offensive coordinator back, who was maybe going to jump ship to buddy up with Coach Saban, but to get him back is huge. I think I'd expect Michael Penix to have a huge year, and keep an eye on the Huskies as maybe being a team that could sneak in there as well.
Mike, I like your call. Excuse me, Max. I like your call on this team offensively with Michael Penix there. Just talk a little bit about this receiving core. For my money, probably the second best receiving core in the country outside of Ohio State. When you look at Odunze and, of course, Polk and McMillan, these guys are absolute dudes on the perimeter.
And it's hard to find who that top guy is. And that's always fun to me. I'm a big X's and O's guy. you know, every defensive coordinator, I think, nets out differently with that question. Roma Dunze might look the best coming off the bus, and he also has the blonde hair, so he sticks out for sure. And I'm sure NFL guys really like his stature and whatnot. He's more of that true X receiver. But you have McMillan in the slot, who gave Oregon fits, who was kind of their big play guy, and he's a mismatch for a lot of linebackers because he is tall and long, but, you know, can be quick and that slot type guy. And so that's the beauty with the Washington offense. You can't focus on one guy. I left out Jalen Polk there. He's a very viable third option, and I'm sure if he heard me say that, he'd be like, hey, I'm the number one guy. And that's really what the Huskies bring to the table. And it's a loaded passing attack. Their offensive coordinator is an absolute stud. I think it'll just be interesting because this is an offense that was atrocious 2 years ago. They came back, had a huge year last year. How do they show up in 2023 with a lot of expectations? That'll be the big question for me.
Thank you very much, Max. Really appreciate it. You can find him, Pac-12 network analyst, at Max Brown 4 on Twitter. We'll be right back with more Sharp Money here shortly.